The Economist magazine from March 21st through March 27th, 2026. On the cover, why America and Cuba should cut a deal. Britain's chancellor reaches out to Europe. How China is chasing fusion power. Economists' odd aversion to sex work. And the cover story shows a picture of Donald Trump with a combat helmet on backwards, covering his eyes. And the title is Operation Blind Fury. Contents from page 3. On the cover, the reckless campaign against Iran will weaken Donald Trump. That will make him angry. Leader, page 7. There's plenty of scope for the fighting to escalate, but no obvious way to end it, page 15. The war could sap American military power for years, page 16. The assassination of senior leaders weakens Iran, but also makes it less predictable, page 18. Despite all the bluster, Mr. Trump's war is weakening him, page 19. Tucker Carlson interview, page 20. Why America and Cuba should cut a deal. It would be dirty, but better than the alternatives, leader, page 9. The regime that has controlled Cuba for over half a century has run out of options, page 25. Britain's chancellor reaches out to Europe. Rachel Reeves torches a decade of post-Brexit orthodoxies, page 45. How China is chasing fusion power. It has made itself a serious contender in the race for commercial fusion, page 71. Is cheap energy the key to China's gaining AI supremacy? Page 33. Understanding China's drive for self-sufficiency in energy and elsewhere. Shaguan, page 36. Economists' odd aversion to sex work. The sex economy is growing. It deserves serious analysis. Free exchange, page 70. We'll also be reading this week, The World This Week, page 5, a summary of political and business news. The Leaders section, page 7, War in Iran, Operation Blind Fury. Page 8, Dislodging Hezbollah. African Economies, Open for Business. Page 9, Cuba's Future, Dealing with Havana. 10, Natural Gas, Lingering Fumes. Also, we'll read the letter section from page 11. By invitation, page 14, Oman's chief diplomat, America has lost control of its foreign policy. Briefing, page 15, the war on Iran, double deadlock. Page 16, America's armed forces, overstretched. 18, who runs Iran? No quarter. Buttonwood, South Korea's epic stock market bull run may survive the energy shock. Page 69. The United States section. A weakened president, page 19. 20, Tucker Carlson's views. 21, Democrats in the war. 22, farmers in pain. 23, securing the homeland. 24. Does Trump care about the midterms? America's, Cuba's broken economy. And we may have time for some other articles. The World This Week, Politics, page 5. Israel killed Ali Larijani, Iran's security chief, and one of the most prominent remaining figures in the regime. Gholam Reza Soleimani, the head of the paramilitary Bazij force, died on the same day Iran's intelligence minister was killed in a separate strike. Iran's army vowed a decisive response to the assassination of Mr. Arijani. Donald Trump condemned an attack by Iran on the Ras Laffan gas complex in Qatar and threatened to massively blow up Iran's South Pars natural gas field if it struck Qatar again. Mr. Trump claimed he had not been informed in advance of the Israeli strike on South Pars that preceded the Iran's attack on Qatar. Joe Kent, a senior American counterterrorism official, resigned over America's war in Iran. Mr. Kent, from the anti-war wing of MAGA, said that Iran posed no imminent threat to America. Mr. Trump derided Mr. Kent as being very weak on security and said it was a good thing he was out. At least three Palestinians were killed in the West Bank on the first deadly Iranian missile attack to hit the territory since the war began 3 weeks ago. Iranian missiles also struck the Emirati port of Fujairah and Dubai's airport. America hit dozens of Iranian military targets on Karj Island, home to Iran's main oil export terminal, including storage depots for missiles and naval mines. The Israeli Defense Force, IDF, told people to evacuate southern Lebanon as it intensified its operations against Hezbollah, launching airstrikes on central Beirut and southern Lebanon. Israel has more than doubled the number of troops it has along the border with Lebanon and began destroying bridges over the Litani River, perhaps in preparation for a ground invasion. Over 950 people have been killed in Lebanon and almost a million displaced since Israel's latest campaign began. A former Belgian diplomat will face trial for his alleged involvement in the assassination in 1961 of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected prime minister of independent Congo. Etienne Davignon, 93, is the sole survivor of the 10 Belgians accused by the Lumumba family of complicity in his death. A parliamentary commission in Belgium, the former colonial power, had found that the country supported the killing. Denis Sassou Nguesso will remain president of the Republic of the Congo after a farcical election marred by an internet blackout and suppression of the opposition. Official results say the 82-year-old, who has ruled the country since 1979, except for a 5-year period in the 1990s, won 95% of the vote. Bobby Wine, an Ugandan opposition leader, said he had left the country because he feared he would be killed by the government. Mr. Wine's exile follows the re-election in January of Yoweri Museveni, the president since 1986, the head of the Ugandan army, who is also Mr. Museveni's son, had threatened to kill Mr. Wine in a string of now-deleted posts on X. Lend a hand? Donald Trump repeated his demands for NATO allies to help open up the Strait of Hormuz to no avail. European leaders made it clear they would not get involved. Friedrich Merz, Germany's chancellor, said, "We will not participate in this war." Emmanuel Macron, president of France, said that the country was not a party to the conflict. Later, Mr. Trump explained on his Truth social media platform that we don't need the help of anyone. France voted in the first round of mayoral elections, Marine Le Pen's populist right and Jean-Luc Mélenchon's populist left made gains. Emmanuel Macron's centrists did poorly. Eric Ciotti, backed by Ms. Le Pen, topped voting in Nice. The socialist incumbent came first in Marseille. A tough race for Paris is in effect, down to Emmanuel Grégoire, a socialist, and Rasida Dati on the right. Final voting is due to take place on March 22nd. A spying scandal upended Slovenia's election campaign ahead of the polls on March 22nd. Maladina, a local news outlet, reported that operatives from Black Cube, an Israeli political intelligence firm, met Janez Jansa, the country's populist opposition leader. The report linked the company to the publication of videos that appeared to implicate government-linked figures in corruption. They deny wrongdoing and say the videos were manipulated. Mr. Jansa denied working with Black Cube, which he did not respond to our requests for comment. Better when we were together. Rachel Reeves, Britain's chancellor, said she wants closer alignment with the European Union to boost economic growth. Ms. Reeves' comments follow the Labour government's reset with the EU since coming to office in 2024. The politics have changed since the Brexit referendum in 2016. Britons now clearly favor rejoining. Donald Trump said he may soon have the honor of taking Cuba. Millions on the island were left without power for more than 24 hours amid a worsening energy crisis. No fuel has entered the Caribbean country since the United States imposed an oil embargo on it 3 months ago. Meanwhile, Rodrigo Chavez, the president of Costa Rica, announced the closure of the country's embassy in Havana. Mr. Chavez, a Trump ally, denied the legitimacy of the Cuban regime, adding that we must cleanse the atmosphere, or the hemisphere, of communists. Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, sacked her defense minister in a sweeping cabinet reshuffle. Ms. Rodriguez thanked Vladimir Padrino, the longest-serving military appointee under dictator Nicolas Maduro, for his loyalty to the homeland. Mr. Padrino will be replaced by Gustavo Gonzalez Lopez, the country's intelligence chief. Ms. Rodriguez has run Venezuela since Maduro's capture by American special forces. Pakistan and Afghanistan agreed to pause fighting to mark Eid el-Fitr, the end of Ramadan. The temporary reprieve of 4 days comes after a Pakistani airstrike on Kabul killed at least 143 people. The Taliban government claimed the attack hit a hospital and that the death toll was as high as 400. Pakistan denied this and said that its forces precisely targeted terrorist infrastructure. Mr. Trump said he was postponing a visit to China as a result of the war with Iran. He had been due to travel to Beijing on March 31st to meet President Xi Jinping. Mr. Trump says the trip will now take place in about 5 or 6 weeks. The World This Week, Business, page 6. The price of Brent crude, the global oil benchmark, rose above $115 a barrel as America and Israel continued their bombing campaign against Iran. The price of natural gas also climbed. The Dutch TTF price, the benchmark price for fuel in Europe, hit €72, $83 per megawatt hour, up from around €30 before the war. Prices increased sharply after Iranian missiles hit Ras Laffan, an industrial complex in Qatar that boasts the world's biggest liquefied natural gas, LNG, plant. Qatar Energy, which runs the plant, said the strike caused extensive damage. Ras Laffan produces a fifth of the world's LNG. Airlines warning that soaring fuel prices were pushing up their costs. The bosses of Delta, United, and American Airlines, three big American carriers, each said that their combined companies' costs had risen by around $400 million in March alone. SAS, Scandinavian's biggest airline, is reducing its services. The price of jet fuel traded in Europe and in Singapore, Asia's main hub, has more than doubled since the start of the war. The Federal Reserve left its main interest rate unchanged, between 3.5 and 3.75%. Traders are increasingly betting that America's central bank, which last cut rates in December, will keep them on hold until the end of the year, amid fears that rising energy costs could fuel inflation. Other central banks signaled caution on account of the war in the Gulf. The Bank of Japan held rates steady. Earlier, the Reserve Bank of Australia lifted them by 0.25 percentage points to 4.1%. Jensen Huang, NVIDIA's boss, gave a bullish presentation at the chip-making titan's annual developer conference. He predicted that the company would sell $1 trillion worth of artificial intelligence, AI kit, by the end of 2027. Mr. Huang unveiled a specialized chip built using technology from a startup called Grok for inference, the stage where AI models answer questions from users. NVIDIA is eager to show that it is branching out into new products. After a blistering rally last year, the company's share price has fallen since the start of 2026, as investors fear that the AI boom will not last. Who saw that coming? Attorney General accused Kalshi, a prediction market, of running an illegal gambling operation. Kalshi denied the charges. The company argues that its contracts, which pay out depending on the outcome of an event, should be regulated as derivatives rather than falling under gambling laws. Arizona is the first state to bring a criminal case against Kalshi. UniCredit made a 35 billion euros, $40 billion bid for Commerzbank, a smaller German rival. Andrea Orczel, the Italian bank's boss, said the lowball offer, pricing Commerzbank's shares at just 4% above their market value, would allow UniCredit to raise its stake in the lender. UniCredit hopes the offer will revive talks over its planned takeover of the bank. Commerzbank and Germany's government both oppose the bid. BHP, the world's biggest miner, named Brandon Craig as its next boss. He will take over on July 1st. The company veteran, who ran the Australian firm's operations in Latin America, will replace Mike Henry. Mr. Henry oversaw several unsuccessful attempts to buy BHP's rival, Anglo American, during his 6 years in charge. Mr. Craig wants to double down on copper, which overtook iron ore to become the firm's most profitable metal last year, and deepen BHP's operations in the Americas. Tencent, China's most valuable company, reported a 13% increase in revenue in the final quarter of last year, compared to the same period in 2024. The maker of WeChat, China's biggest social media app, has been working on integrating agentic AI services into its products, which allow users to automate tasks such as hailing rides and ordering food. In December, it hired Yao Shunyu of OpenAI, a leading American lab, as its chief AI scientist. JD.com, a Chinese e-commerce giant, launched its online marketplace in Europe for the first time. Joybuy, with which stocks products from big brands like Apple, aims to challenge Amazon. It hopes that offering same-day delivery deals to around 15 million households on the continent will help it gain an edge on its American rival, which dominates e-commerce in Europe and America. Hover and out. The share price of Swarmer, a Texas-based company that develops AI software for coordinating military drones, rose by more than 1,000% following its initial public offering on the NASDAQ on March 17. Ukraine's armed forces have used the company's wares since 2024. The Trump administration has recently sped up the rush to develop America's drone tech. Last year, it all but banned imports of Chinese-made drones for national security reasons. The political cartoon this week is one panel. And in the panel, it shows Donald Trump entering, opening a door that says NATO on it. And he's holding a book on Iran that's burning. His hair is singed on the front, and there's a fire in smoke pouring in the door. Huddled behind the door are leaders from NATO. The Economist magazine continues on page 7. This is the leader section. Operation Blind Fury. The reckless campaign against Iran will weaken America's president. That will make him angry. Never bet against Donald Trump. No politician can defy political gravity like the man whose supporters stormed the Capitol on January 6th, 2021, only for him to be reelected in 2024 with a bigger share of the vote. And yet, it's hard to imagine a crisis more precisely engineered to intercept the trajectory of his presidency than his ill-judged, heedless war against Iran. Even a short war will alter the course of his second term. One that lasts months could bring it crashing to earth. The reason is that the fight against Iran diminishes Mr. Trump's three political superpowers: his ability to impose his own reality on the world, his remorseless use of leverage, and his dominion over the Republican Party. Even without Iran, the potency of these Trumpian strengths was likely to wane after the midterm elections. Wars accelerate change. Start with Trump versus reality. In politics, the president has shown a remarkable ability to twist facts, and sure enough, he insists that he has already triumphed in Iran. Yet the war tells a truth of its own. Iran's regime cannot win in any conventional sense. But despite widespread destruction of infrastructure and the assassinations of senior leaders, including the security chief, Ali Larijani, Iran's regime survives for now, and its 400 kgs or so of near-nuclear-ready uranium remains at large. What is more, Iran is waging its own parallel war against the global energy industry as it strikes shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and the infrastructure of its neighbors. The markets are keeping score, with Brent crude spiking to more than $110 a barrel on March 18th, following an Iranian missile attack on the Qatari natural gas hub. The regime will conclude that its strategy is working. If anything, time is on Iran's side. America and Israel will gradually run out of useful targets to strike from the air, or run low on interceptor batteries to see off Iranian weapons. By contrast, Iran appears still to have plenty of drones. For as long as it restricts traffic in the strait, oil prices will climb, and the damage to the world economy will grow. Mr. Trump's second superpower is leverage. Now that other countries' leaders have come to expect rough treatment, they're learning how to resist. When the president called on America's allies to help open the strait, warning that NATO faces a very bad future if they refused, they turned him down. He quickly reversed course, pretending he had never needed help. Likewise, Iran is opposing Mr. Trump by accumulating leverage against him. In recent days, it has signaled that it will grant safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz to ships from friendly countries, a sign that it means to use the strait as a bargaining tool. Even if Mr. Trump wants to end the war, Iran could continue to fire at ships. If the waterway remains closed until the end of April, the oil price could reach $150 a barrel. Given that leverage, Iran may hold out for more than just a return to the status quo before the war. It may ask for sanctions to be lifted or an American commitment to abandon some bases in the Middle East or to restrain Israel. If recession looms in America and stock markets start to fall, would Mr. Trump escalate by, say, seizing Kharj Island, home to Iran's export terminals, or would he buckle? The answer depends partly on the lost part of his powers, his hold on his party. Mr. Trump was elected on the promise to spare voters from war and inflation. So far, 13 American service personnel have died. Ground operations inside Iran to recover that uranium are on Kharj would put many more in danger. Average prices of petrol and diesel have reached $3.88 and $5.09 a gallon, compared with $3.11 and $3.72 at Mr. Trump's inauguration. Republican support for the war is strong, but softening. A vocal faction of MAGA, notably Tucker Carlson, interviewed on The Insider, our video show this week, talks of betrayal. In private, many elected Republicans are seething. See under United States section. Mr. Trump's failure to heed warnings about the Strait of Hormuz is typical of his contempt for strategy and his hubris in thinking he knows better than people who really do. Republicans are now highly likely to lose control of the House in midterm elections in November. Their chances of losing the Senate, too, have risen by 10 points to about 50%. The worse the defeat, the lamer a duck the president will be, and the less influence he will have over who inherits the party. Were the war to drag on, leading to very high oil prices and tumbling stock markets, Mr. Trump could seek a way out and look for a win somewhere else, in, say, Cuba. Markets would doubtless register relief if the fighting stopped, but Mr. Trump is not in full control of this war. Iran's attack on the gas hub in Qatar shows it has cards to play, and even if the fighting ended tomorrow, it could take 4 to 6 weeks to restore oil production, 4 to 8 weeks to settle oil markets, and two months to normalize shipping. The risk of renewed Iranian action would remain. Prices would stay high for months. Every day they do weakens the president. Mr. Trump's politics depends on the strength that comes from winning. If he seems a loser, expect him to exact retribution. A weaker president could become a more dangerous one. Tanking. Mr. Trump is freest to act abroad. He may abandon NATO. He may cut Ukraine loose to punish Europe. He could bully Latin America in the name of fighting crime and drugs. He may demand money for defending Japan and South Korea. He will be maximalist on tariffs. Even if he does not succeed, that will further erode American alliances to the glee of China and Russia. But Mr. Trump is also liable to lash out at home. He has already endorsed the idea of withholding broadcasting licenses from media outlets that criticize the war. He wants the Federal Reserve to slash rates, but his war makes that less likely. Expect further clashes with the central bank. He could target perceived enemies and send immigration agents to more Democratic-run cities. He could threaten to meddle in the midterms, either as theater to rile his opponents or because he intends to influence the results. It is hard to see how Mr. Trump ends up a winner in Iran. Be warned, he makes a very bad loser. Leaders, continued on page 8. Dislodging Hezbollah, Lebanon's last chance. The country's leaders must seize the opportunity to take on Hezbollah. Israel must not play the spoiler. More often than not, Lebanon is a cautionary tale. Poor governance, foreign meddling, and catastrophic economic mismanagement have hollowed out the state. But the most destabilizing force in the country has been Hezbollah, a fearsome militia backed by Iran. Lebanon's government now has a chance to dislodge it, but needs to act firmly and fast. Hezbollah, long the most heavily armed non-state actor in the world and the most powerful military force in Lebanon, has never looked weaker. Israel has killed many of its leaders, destroyed tens of thousands of the missiles, and has pointed at North Israel. Its patron is now battling for its own survival. Anger has grown among its Shia supporters in Lebanon at its failure to rebuild what Israel destroyed in the south of the country in 2024. Since Israel and America began their most recent war in Iran, Hezbollah has once again been attacking Israel. In response, Israel has launched a devastating series of airstrikes, which have killed over 950 people and displaced more than a million. Israel aims to finally smash Hezbollah. Instead, it risks reviving it. In contrast to Israel's campaign in 2024, which many Lebanese recognized to be an attack on Hezbollah, the scale of this assault makes it look like an attack on Lebanon itself. A ground incursion may be next. See Middle East and Africa section. Israel's invasion in 1982 led to an 18-year occupation of southern Lebanon and the emergence of Hezbollah. Fighting a new wave of occupiers would help Hezbollah recover its grip. Israel should pause and give Lebanon's government and army a chance to act. For years, that would have been inconceivable. Generations of Lebanese politicians and generals have prevaricated, reluctant to take on a militia that outgunned and intimidated them. Israel's leaders are currently split over whether to launch a large ground invasion. If the Lebanese government does not rise to the occasion, Israel may well conclude that it must reestablish deterrence itself, perhaps with a prolonged occupation of the south. Lebanon's leaders are making the right noises. Joseph Aoun, the president, has vowed to disarm the group. On March 2nd, Nawaf Salam, the prime minister, declared all Hezbollah's security and military activities to be illegal and told it to hand over its weapons to the state. Dismantling Hezbollah's power will neither be easy nor quick, but the government could start by ejecting the Iranian ambassador and severing diplomatic ties with Iran. Many Iranian diplomats in Lebanon are, in fact, members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The government should arrest Iranian commanders leading Hezbollah's fighters on the ground. It must also close Al-Quad El-Hassan, its financial network, and make clear that reconstruction financing for the south of the country will be made available and handled by the state. And it should enforce its own ban on Hezbollah's military activity. Recently, armed Hezbollah supporters were arrested and then freed on bail of just $21. The army should take control of the routes and facilities used to move weapons and fighters. And Lebanon's army should eventually aim to move into areas long dominated by Hezbollah. Outsiders can help. Britain and France could share intelligence with Lebanon's government. So could America. Their armies could train and equip the Lebanese armed forces and offer financial support to pay soldiers. But ultimately, this is up to Lebanon's leaders. If they move seriously against Hezbollah, they might at last break its grip on the state. If they hesitate, yet again, Lebanon would face a destructive new occupation. Leaders continued. African economies open for business. The continent's resilience in the face of aid cuts has been underestimated. You might think that Africa would be in the midst of a crisis. The four largest donors all cut their aid spending in Africa last year, according to initial data. America slapped some of its highest tariffs on African countries. China, the continent's largest bilateral source of loans for most of the 21st century, today receives more from Africa in debt repayments than it extends in new credit. On top of that, all that, the war in Iran will increase the cost of fuel and fertilizer. Yet African countries look resilient. The IMF reckons that in 2026, economic aid will be higher in Africa than in Asia, hitherto a rare occurrence. Of the 15 fastest-growing countries anywhere, 11 are expected to be on the continent. The picture partly reflects high commodity prices and booming populations, but it also revealing of something more profound. The rise of Africa as a destination for investment, not charity. See international section. To be sure, there is not one Africa. Some of the continent is at war, Sudan, or unstable, the Sahel. But the most economically important parts are not. Internal strife can coexist with thriving industries, even within the same country. Take, for example, energy or fintech in Nigeria. And though aid remains vital to the budgets of the poorest places, for the larger economies, it is a rounding error. Before the outbreak of the Third Gulf War, animal spirits were on something of a safari. In the first 2 months of 2026, the value of bonds issued by African countries on capital markets was higher than during any equivalent period since 2013. The ratings of African sovereign bonds remained at a five-year high. Last year, many African stock markets reached record highs. The price rises for fuel and fertilizer, and therefore food, caused by the war, may stunt these movements, but there are three reasons to be optimistic that the investment case for Africa will continue to be promising. The first is that Africa is attracting a wider range of foreign investors than ever. In 2024, the continent received a record amount of foreign direct investment at $97 billion, about a third more than the inflow of aid. For both America and Europe, Africa has grown in importance as a source of critical minerals and a destination for infrastructure spending. The chaos in the Gulf may redouble European firms' interest in Africa's energy projects, whether oil, gas, or renewables, a shift that began when Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine in 2022. China, though, lending less, is trading at or near record levels with the continent. The Gulf states may rethink some of their investments, given the damage caused by the war, but they still have an appetite for Africa's agricultural and mineral riches. A second reason is that African policymakers have made their economies more resilient. Inflation slowed down in most countries last year, in part because of prudent central bankers. Market-friendly reforms in Nigeria and South Africa will boost these large economies and their surrounding regions. Efforts to reduce intra-African trade barriers to trade, capital flows, and movement of people are picking up. More than twice as much rail may be laid in the next 10 years as in the past decade. The third reason for optimism is probably the most crucial. African investors are starting to put more of their capital into Africa. In 2024, the 500 largest African firms recorded their highest ever revenues in dollar terms. As these firms grow, they are reinvesting in new projects. This trend is exemplified by Aliko Dangote, a Nigerian tycoon and Africa's richest man, who has built a massive refinery complex outside Lagos and plans to expand across the continent See Middle East and Africa section. Last year, local investors accounted for 45% of venture capital commitments in Africa, the highest ever share. New rules in many places mean that some of the $1 trillion-plus on the balance sheets of pension, insurance, and sovereign wealth funds will go to private equity and infrastructure, not just bills and bonds. Africa still faces huge challenges. The flip side of its demographic boom is that 15 million young people will soon be entering the labor market every year, most of them without hope of a formal job. Electricity remains patchy and costly. Agricultural productivity, while improving, lags behind global averages. The share of children in primary school has stalled since 2010. Complacent African politicians are often reluctant to allow the rise of large businesses that owe their success to entrepreneurship rather than political connections. Too many corrupt autocracies opt to repress restless populations rather than to uplift them. Even so, it is time for the world to update how it thinks about Africa. The Middle East is at war again. Europe is sluggish, and America is run by its own would-be autocrat. As a result, the continent is starting to seem less and less risky. Relatively speaking, Africa looks a safer bet than ever. Leaders continued on page 9. Cuba's future. Dealing with Havana. A deal with the Cuban regime would be dirty, but better than the alternatives. Not since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 has the United States held so much power over Cuba's fate. By taking control of the distribution of Venezuelan oil after capturing Nicolas Maduro, that country's dictator, America cut Cuba off from its last reliable energy supplier. The threat of renewed tariffs has prevented other friendly countries, like Mexico, from stepping in. Many countries that employed Cuban doctors and paid the regime directly for their service have been bullied into sending them back, cutting off precious foreign currency. On March 16th, the power went out across the whole of Cuba for the fourth time in 5 months. Protests are increasing. Temperatures are rising. See America's section. Not for the first time, the goal of an American pressure campaign is unclear. I do believe I'll be having the honor of taking Cuba, Donald Trump said on March 16th. Whether I free it, take it, I think I can do anything I want with it. Marco Rubio, his Cuban-American Secretary of State, is more diplomatic, but just as opaque. Cuba's status quo is unacceptable, he said on February 25th, after meeting regime officials at St. Kitts and Nevis. Cuba needs to change, and it doesn't have to change all at once. Who knows what that means? What is clear is that the regime has been forced to negotiate. On March 13th, Miguel Diaz-Canel, Cuba's president, admitted publicly to speaking to the Americans. A deal appears to be taking shape, modeled on the one that the Trump administration has cut with the regime in Venezuela. The Americans have, in fact, been allowing fuel to be shipped to Cuba since the middle of February, but only via the private sector. Under the deal, this arrangement could be expanded. the country would open up to American investment, particularly in energy. Political prisoners would be released, and exiles would be permitted to return, not just as tourists, but as business owners. Crucially, the Castro family and most of the ruling figures clustered around it seem likely to hold on to power. The Cubans in St. Kitts included Fidel's nephew and great-nephew. Mr. Diaz-Canel holds little real clout, but he may well end up by being ousted to satisfy Mr. Trump and protect the Castros. It's as remarkable that a communist regime has managed to survive for 67 years with the world's most powerful nation just 100 miles away, bent on its destruction. To do so, the regime has regularly reneged on agreements like the one Mr. Trump is considering. Many of those who care about Cuba, particularly Cuban Americans in the United States, argue any deal that does not involve the departure of the Castro network from the island and the end of the regime. But after six decades of single-party rule, the regime is too entrenched to be removed at a stroke. Instead, Messrs. Trump and Rubio are in a position to negotiate an opening up that may eventually lead to the regime's demise. The Americans should enforce compliance to a far greater extent than they have in the past. If the regime starts using shadow fleet tankers to import fuel, bypassing the private sector, America could seize them. If the release of political prisoners stalls, the supply of oil could be stalled too. Sanctions would remain in place with licenses being used to allow investment. If the private sector can be helped to grow faster than the state-controlled economy, the regime's latitude of control will shrink. Over time, America should then demand political liberalization too. Cutting a deal may let the regime cling on, but the alternatives are worse. If Mr. Trump ends his blockade with nothing to show for it, the regime may be empowered. Continuing to squeeze in the hope of igniting protests that topple the strong man is unlikely to work. Cubans pay a high price for challenging their government. In the past, many have preferred simply to leave the country. A prolonged blockade risks creating a humanitarian crisis on America's doorstep. That would be bad for Cubans and bad for the United States, and would risk pushing Cuba further into the arms of China and Russia. Mr. Trump wrongly thinks he can run the Western Hemisphere through aggression alone. When it comes to Cuba, he has an opportunity to do what he thinks he does best, make a deal. Then he should stick to it. Letters, page 11. The cost of putting AI in orbit. I enjoyed your piece on why data centers in space are less crazy than we might think. Orbiting number crunching, March 7th. However, you underestimated the cost and supply constraints of space-grade solar generators. Satellite design costs could fall to less than $5 per watt, you say. In reality, the baseline price for a space-grade photovoltaic triple junction cell is closer to $1,000 per watt, and supply is highly constrained. It is true that massive speculative demand could eventually drive price economies of scale for cheaper silicon-based cells, $20 to $100 per watt. But these cells operate at only two-thirds of the efficiency of triple-function cells, suffer from uncertain long-term radiation degradation, and lack the manufacturing base for high-quantity procurement. Also, your assumptions regarding thermal management require careful scrutiny. An international space station already utilizes extremely efficient state-of-the-art radiator systems. Although it's true that an unmanned data center satellite could improve specific power by stripping away the heavy fail-safes required for human life support and for equipment to operate at high temperatures, bridging the remaining gap to a tenfold increase in heat dissipation per kilogram remains speculative. Finally, the competitive model relies on launch costs falling dramatically to $500 per kilogram. Next generation heavy lift vehicles may eventually alter the economics, but SpaceX currently holds a quasi-monopoly in the market. In real terms, the actual cost for rideshare and dedicated Falcon 9 launches have remained flat for the past 6 years. All these realities suggest a realistic timeline is closer to 15 years rather than the 2 to 3 years being touted. Tobias Friedenberg, Munich. What Europe must do on AI. You're right that the mindset in Europe is changing with regards to AI, breeding unicorns, March 7th. For European tech to stand a real chance, 3 things need to happen. First, AI startups must form partnerships with strong traditional industries, the backbone of many European economies. If they leverage industrial data meaningfully, that's when the party starts. Second, governments across the EU need to bundle their activities instead of creating small AI clusters here and there. Third, law enforcers must ensure open and competitive markets. Governments are still blindly relying on big tech, thereby perpetuating dependencies and lock-ins. Free competition drives innovation, not the puny hope of being integrated into the ecosystem of a big tech player. Rupert Podsum, co-chair, German Government Commission on Competition and AI, Düsseldorf.